Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we get spooky. National bestselling author Paul Tremblay discusses his latest summer blockbuster horror movie, A Novel. He is joined in conversation by fellow writer Gus Moreno. The following conversation originally took place May 13th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
Good evening. Good evening. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the American Writers Museum. Thank you all for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. From Stephen King to Shirley Jackson to John Carpenter, America's horror writers have pulled back the curtain on our darkest imaginings and made us face our worst fears. In Paul Tremblay's new novel, Horror Movie, he tells the tale of a cult film's consequences and explores how art imitates life and vice versa. Paul Tremblay has won the Bram Stoker British Fantasy and Massachusetts Book Awards and is the national best-selling author of The Beast You Are, The Pallbearers Club, Survivor Song, Growing Things and Other Stories, Disappearance at Devil's Rock, A Head Full of Ghosts, and the crime novels The Little Sleep and No Sleep Till Wonderland. His novel The Cabin at the End of the World was adapted into the Universal Pictures film Knock at the Cabin. He's joined in conversation tonight by Gus Moreno, author of This Thing Between Us, a best book of 2021 pick by NPR and the New York Public Library. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Hello, Paul.
Hey, Gus.
Hey,
good to see you again.
Good. It's great to be here. Thanks for everyone for coming out.
Yes, thank you, everybody. Thank you, American Museum, Writers Museum. This is amazing. I wish I was here earlier to look at everything.
I know, right? There's like a lot of cool stuff here. So let's just get right into it.
All right.
What drew you to the found or the cursed film subgenre?
The initial sort of spark or what if of horror movie was just a fun. I mean, I guess at some point, like, you're always surprised by a what if, but like, I wasn't thinking of writing a cursed movie book. I actually had a different novel in my head, but I didn't love it, so it was like a sign I probably shouldn't do that. So anyway, I guess I'll name drop it. Friend Stephen Graham Jones, he texted me randomly, like, hey, you know, you should, there's this film critic who lives out in Denver, Walter Chow, you know, an amazing film critic. During the pandemic, he was doing matinees via the Denver Public Library. And after showing a movie, he would have this amazing conversation with sometimes the director or someone associated with the film. So the first one I watched was Walter and John Darnielle, writer and, you know, Mountain Goats musician, talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And then that sent me into a sort of a Texas Chainsaw Massacre rabbit hole. You know, so, you know, that movie, obviously, you know, one of the most famous horror movies. I didn't watch that until I was probably in my mid-30s because I was afraid to watch it. Have you seen it?
Yeah, it was like a recent watch. I mean, recent in like in my 30s.
Yeah. My brother, who's 5 years younger than me, total gore hound. Like, we're both horror fans, but I was always more the supernatural guy, and like, I would have to cover my eyes. during the scene in Poltergeist where he's tearing his face off, sorry for the spoilers, I'd be like, come on, Dan, you can't watch this. But it was more like I didn't want to watch the face being torn off. So anyway, that little psycho watched Texas Chainsaw when he was 10. But, you know, so like for so many people, like just, you know, the cultural sort of memory of Chainsaw is like this super gory movie. And, you know, and if you've seen it, obviously it's not. It's like surprisingly blood-free for much of it. So anyway, I finally watched the movie. I was like, wow, this is actually great. And then I watched the YouTube video, these really smart people talking about this movie, and Walter actually held up an audiobook that Gunnar Hansen had written called Chainsaw Confidential. It's really hard to find the book in print, so I found it as an audiobook. And Gunnar read it, and he was just so like weirdly gleeful and like purposefully, you know, as a joke, sort of like, oh, you know, is it me or Leatherface, like trying to blur that line. So I know with that, like, and I was like, oh, and like the chances that they took on that set, you know, before the reunions and protections was like, you know, what would drive these people sort of to do that? And that became like the opening part of horror movies. Like, okay, I want to write about this movie where people took chances and maybe, you know, one of the chances didn't really work out.
So I did watch that video, that discussion between Walter Chaw and John Darnielle.
Yeah.
Which is, everyone should watch it after you read the book, just because it gives, like, I think it gives in then talking about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it gives context to your book, too, in a strange way.
I know. I should go back and watch and see how much I stole.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that John talks about, like, the Greek tragedy, you know, setup and how, like, he views Texas Chainsaw as a Greek tragedy because, like, the characters are, like, doomed to their fate from the very beginning, but we, as the audience, can see, like, all of these times when they could have avoided their fate.
Right.
And I just wanted to ask, like, is horror movie a Greek tragedy?
Oh, I have to admit, I mean, I was a math major, so, like, I didn't study Greek tragedy. I'm aware of it. Like, I don't know the pieces, but no, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I wanted there to be, it's not a spoiler to know that something terrible happens towards the end of the filming of the movie, and that hangs over the story. You know, and oftentimes a bunch of the characters, either in the script or the thin kid as he's narrating, talk. You know, there's the question of predetermination or you know, the concatenation of choices that sort of lead to what happens. So, I guess indirectly, that's there. Or just, I mean, just from, like, being someone who's aware of Western culture, I mean, that stuff's going to be there.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Gunnar Hansen book. What is it like your relationship with research? Like, personally, I hate it.
Oh, I hate it.
So is it the same for you? Like, did you just go as far as the Gunnar book and then we're like, I got it from here?
Yeah, no, because I'm not very confident in research. Again, I'm going to blame math. You know, I wasn't an English or a history major where you had to do papers and stuff like that and research. So, but the research for this was a little bit fun. You know, besides listening to the audiobook, and then actually I paid a little bit extra, found an eBay copy of the hardcover. But you know, I did talk to some filmmaking friends just to get some, like, basic questions and answers. I did read, I'm so bad, I'm going to forget, Rodriguez, what's his first name? Robert Rodriguez. He wrote a book about, like, independent filmmaking.
Yeah.
I forget the title. I was kind of hoping it would be more like how to do it, but which was fine. It wasn't that. It was just more like sort of the spirit, like all the stuff that he did.
Like Down and Dirty, something like that, right?
Something like that, no. Yeah. So otherwise, I just sort of, like, went for it. And then, I mean, I was just very lucky that, like, about, like, 3 months into the writing of the book, I got to go to the set of Knock at the Cabin. And to me, that was, like, a real eye-opener, even though that movie was, you know, much more big budget than what's horror movie is. It was just really interesting. So, you know, I'm a novelist. Like, I've never really watched a movie on set before, just to see the collaborative thing in person. And, you know, just little things like the script supervisor. He was really the thing that holds everything together. Like, everyone came to the script supervisor. You know, he was in charge of continuity, writing down the shots, like, what order, and, like, naming the different shots. And, you know, and he was super cool. Like, he just had, like, a stand-up laptop and... was almost like a court stenographer at the same time. Like, it was, like, wild. So that was, like, a happy thing just to have that experience too.
Okay. So in the beginning of the book, our narrator, who's only known as the Thin Kid, is meeting with a producer on a possible remake of horror movie. And the producer, like, immediately is, like, strike one. And when he talks about, like, the movie in terms of, like, character arcs and, like, acts, and the narrator just, like, is not with that, describing, you know, story in that way at all. Yeah. Like, is there anything in literature or horror in general that you just, like, wish people would stop talking about like that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it's obnoxious. I mean, I'm sure screenwriters are probably sick of, like, novelists talking about, like, what's wrong with screenplays or I shouldn't say what's wrong with screenplays. I guess I'm more sort of, like, really sort of chafe at the idea of, like, every screenplay, you know, particularly when it's, like, American studio movies, has to have three acts. And they break it down to, like, beats. Like, I don't even know what a beat is.
I don't know what an act is.
You know, you think the math person would like the idea of, like, the beats, you know, every 10 pages or something. Is like, have you guys ever watched, like, The Wailing or, you know, Asian cinema or European cinema, like, where there's, I don't know how many acts there are.
Right. And it jumps from genre to genre.
Yeah. Why don't we just, cool, like, write what's a good story? And right. Then, you know, worry about after. But so that's the only thing that, like, for me, it's like, you know, why does it have to be, like, this weird formula? We're not writing haikus. I mean, I understand why haikus have to have, you know, set rules. We're writing screenplays. Why not just do, like, a cool story? I don't know.
Right. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know anything about screenwriting. Clearly, after you read the screenplay that's in horror movie, that's true.
So the structure, I mean, usually your books have, like, a very unique structure where they're, like, mixing media, and with horror movie, It's part audiobook, part script from horror movie, the original incantation of it. Like, how do you come up? Is structure something you know from the beginning, or is structure something you like discover as you're writing it?
I'd say the structure sort of comes early on, but like certainly not with like the original What If. Like part of it is like, okay, I want to have this movie, like some of the logic that went into it was like in the beginning, I'm going to have these, you know, young filmmakers making a movie. It has to be old enough that they weren't necessarily going by union rules, which haven't been, you know, hadn't been established, but I couldn't go all the way back to the 70s because then the thin kid would be too old now. So it's like, oh, 93, perfect, you know, Gen X thing again. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it. Then I was like, well, I need the whole original movie. It'd be really boring if I just, you know, had characters describe the movie. So it's like, oh, I'll include the screenplay. And I just get excited. I often get excited when there's an opportunity to do something goofy on the page. You know, I say goofy, playfully goofy, or something different. Like I, you know, I'm always drawn to sort of postmodern different ways of showing. You know, that just reflects my interest as a reader. Like I love House of Leaves. Oh, yeah. You know, I love any sort of bells and whistles. As long as it's there for a reason, it can't just be there to be like a, you know, just be there to be there. It has to be the way the story is best told. So once I knew I was going to include the screenplay, like, you know, the work was, okay, I have to make sure it has to be there. I know my editor, who's the best editor in the world. Like, she is my hero. With every book I turn in, it was no different this time. Like, she read, like, the first, like, 20 pages of horror movies. Like, does the screenplay have to be there? Like, readers don't like reading screenplays. I'm like, read the whole book and then come back to me, see what you think.
Yeah.
I mean, I promise it has to be there.
Yeah, because the screenplay is not even written like a screenplay. Like, it Cleo, right? Cleo, yeah. Like, makes that clear from the beginning. Like, this is how it needs to be told, but it's obviously not how a screenplay is, like, put together.
I mean, so she's up front, like, oh, I know this breaks the rules, but this is how we have to tell the story, which is something, you know, my inner 23-year-old Gen Xer would still, you know, wants to say, you know, say this is how it has to be for art, but also for the purposes of a novel. Like, I needed to be able to, like, do some interior stuff with the screenplay, because part of the screenplay is there to give character development, because, again, not a really big spoiler, but like all the actors playing the characters in the movie have the same name. So it's a fun line to blur. It's like, oh, wait a minute, is the Cleo character and the Cleo playing Cleo the same?
And when you're reading it, you also like forget, you're like, oh yeah, I'm in the screenplay. Like yeah. it tricks you like in some weird way.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
So like your first, I would say like your first four horror novels, I feel like played with the supernatural in terms of like, is the supernatural real, or is it our fear that is manipulating us into acting in ways we would not normally act? Where with like this book and The Pallbearers Club, I kind of feel like memory has become like a new thread that you've been working with. Is that like something you did purposefully, or is it just like you've always been working with memory?
I think it's honestly like more the always side of things. You know, obviously like write what you know is terrible advice, but for writers, but write your obsessions is great advice, because they're going to be there whether you want them or not. You know, my first novel that was published called The Little Sleep plays around with memory and identity. And like someone pointed out to me, he's like, you know, you kind of do this a lot with your short stories. It's like, oh,
yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, like I didn't realize that. You know, it's actually nice to have that knowledge. So, you know, in some ways it feels comfortable, but also at the same time, like, I don't know, for horror stories, like, why not mess around with like the liminality and uncertainty of memory and identity and reality? I mean, to me, that's one of my favorite sort of horror stories live, including your novel, This Thing Between Us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Can we talk about the 90s?
Yeah.
So the 90s, man, your last two books kind of like roughly take place in the same 90s era, but they're not written from like the state of nostalgia. Like you really grounded in the 90s, but then like continue the story from there. So I was wondering, is nostalgia, like is writing in the 90s kind of like the temptation for nostalgia is there? Or like how do you like toe that line?
Yeah, I mean, I think this temptation's always there. We wouldn't be human otherwise, right? Like, you know, so many memories of how we grew up, no matter how difficult that was, there's still some like things that glow like, oh, this was really cool. But, you know, we know the truth is that, you know, nostalgia is poisonous. It's dangerous. It's part of the reason why, you know, the world is in such a dangerous political state is because there's too many people, you know, have this weird notion of, you know, how great life used to be, et cetera.
Back in the day.
You know, and obviously that's always been there. Like, I remember my grandparents complaining to my parents about, like, oh, how great it was back then. But it's just amplified now with all the, you know, Reddit threads and, you know, misinformation, et cetera. So, like, you know, purposely for both books, I wanted to write anti-nostalgia books. Like, no, things were bad. Like, they, I mean, not to discount what's happening now, but things have always been bad, you know, certainly for subsets of, you know, certainly for marginalized communities, it was worse or equally bad. I don't know how to quantify that. But yeah, I wanted to make sure it wasn't like, oh, this is a stranger's thing, or a stranger's thing where, like, you know, everyone's having fun at school.
It's like, and we're all in, like, neon clothes and stuff. Yeah. So horror movie also just, like, deconstructs the, I guess, like, the auteur theory where, like, the director is this, like, driving force behind a film. Like, Cleo, Valentina, even Carson, I would say the Thin Kid too, they all come together to, like, make this singular thing. Do you think the same thing happens in literature?
That's a great question. I mean, my instinct would be to say no, but, like, because part of what I was really interested in was, you know, being writers, like, you know, obviously editors come into play if we have first readers, but, you know, the bulk of the time is just us being, like, lonely weirdos typing on the computer, right? Or writing out longhand if you're a real weirdo, like my friend John Langan. So I was fascinated by the idea of collaboration, because I've never really, you know, done that, certainly not on the, like, the level of a film. And particularly interested in, okay, here's this, like, independent, low budget, you know, they're not going to be rich. Like, that's not the motivating factor. You know, what is, you know, what's the motivation? Like, what's driving this, you know, small group of people to come together and make this thing that, you know, is ultimately, you know, very risky. Like, they're taking financial risks, right? I mean, the Thin Kid quits his job. That's not a huge spoiler again, but, you know, low money, taking mental health risks, financial risks, and, you know, ultimately physical risks. You know, and again, thinking back to a movie like Texas Chainsaw, where they were using a live chainsaw in a lot of instances when they shouldn't have been. So I was just like, man, where's that line? Where's the line? You know, so this is writ small. Where's the line where the small group of people start making decisions that are for the benefit of the movie over the individuals? You know, because we can really extrapolate that to states, corporations, you know, the line where, like, corporations are people too. Like, when when these things, like, when people start making these weird decisions for the benefit of this thing that they're making. So I don't think that really happens in writing. In writing, it's a much more auteur thing, I think, like, where you're in charge of everything. You know, an editor will come tell you what they think doesn't work, and then I get upset.
I think that, but so I guess that's what I'm like, well, yeah, you do have, like, your editor. Do you have beta readers?
It depends. Like, for this one, I had, like, four actors, filmmakers, screenwriters read it, you know, just see how they felt like the movie stuff was. You know, so they were great, very helpful. Paul Burr's Club, I didn't give it to very, very many beta readers. Maybe I should have. I try to curate it to the book, honestly. Like, just even to fool myself, like, hey, everything you're doing has to serve this thing, and this thing's different than the thing before.
Gotcha. I have a blurb that I want to read.
Okay.
And hopefully you can identify who this is. Whoever thought that my little boy, who was afraid of the dark, would write this disturbing book?
That was Ma.
Yeah. So this was in a blog post for Barnes & Noble about being, like, a scaredy cat. I am also a fellow scaredy cat. I would make my little brother, like, if we were in the living room and, like, a trailer for the new Leprechaun movie came on, I would run out of the room and then make him tell me when it, like, stopped. And then all the times he'd be like, yeah, it's done. And then I'd come in, I'd be like, no, it's not done! Like, so, fellow scaredy cat.
Yeah, sure.
Is there an advantage to being a scaredy cat horror author?
I think so. I mean, I think it keeps me from being maybe too cynical. Like I'm never scared by what I'm writing, though. Like, I'm too close to the gears, but, like, I feel like I can intellectualize, oh yeah, this would freak me out, or this would be scary. You know, in so many of my stories, this might sound dumb, but, like, I came to the realization, like, man, just about every novel, most of my stories always have a moment where someone's, like, alone in a room in the dark. You know, just sort of the fundamental kid fear that I still have, because I still go up the basement stairs quick if I have to go in the basement, or if I'm the only one home, lights are on. Like, I've definitely slept with a desk or my wife's desk lamp, which is over there. So it's not as pathetic as the desk lamp that's next to my head. Yeah, in a weird way, that's almost like, not in the moment it's fun, but that's almost like the fun fear. Like mm-hmm. it's just this connection to the childhood, you know, before like the adult fear sort of took over.
Right, the real fears.
Yeah.
I can't watch horror movies if my wife is like out of town. I just can't.
That's
so wise. In each of your books, like I would say the scariest book of yours that I've read is Survivor Song. I don't know, maybe it's the time that I was reading it that was like freaking me out. But then you follow it with The Pallbearers Club, which is horror, but it was like your mongrels in a sense that it's more like a character study.
Yeah.
And then you like ramp it back up again with horror movie. Are you setting out to write like the scariest thing you can with each book, or is like a really scary book something you have to like ramp up to?
That's a great question. It's sort of like it's depended sometimes. Like before Cabin at the End of the World, like I wanted to write like a really disturbing, like that was a goal, to find a story that mm-hmm. would fit like something really scary. And Survivor Song, I just, I had a year left to write a book and I hadn't had anything yet. And I was freaking out. I had a different book idea and then Survivor Song sort of landed in my lap a little bit. I was like, oh, this will be short. Because the other thing I wanted to write was going to take more than a year, which I'm not writing anyway. So after Survivor Song, though, because Survivor Song and Cabin were written sort of back to back, and they both have some thriller components to them in a very short time frame. And all I knew was like, you know, that was kind of exhausting. I want to write something that takes a breath and is a little bit more expansive, at least if nothing else in the timeline. And then sort of Pallbearers came up. I don't know, like, I'm a terrible judge of what's scary. Like I have no, I know it's like disturbing and like hopefully emotionally moves the reader. So I figured horror movie was definitely disturbing.
Oh, it's definitely disturbing.
To the point where like when, you know, I turned in and like my publisher was like super excited and the sales team was excited. I'm like, really? This one? The sales team's excited about this
you
one?
You sickos?
Like, all right.
So you mentioned math earlier. When are we getting to like a math horror novel?
I don't know. I know. It's terrible. Like, I don't have one.
I think, I mean, like, there's...
Josh Malamore wrote, like, a really fun math short story for Shirley Jackson anthology, When Things Get Dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's like math is illegal. You can't mention it. Ooh. Yeah, it's really weird. It's fun.
So, you know, you're a writer, you're a teacher, you're a parent. Like, do you have any advice for, like, aspiring writers who are also juggling those same responsibilities?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's funny, I didn't start writing until I started teaching. Like, it was literally like the first September I went to teach, I just started like a weird idea to try writing a short story. It's almost inexplicable. So they've been tied together forever. Like, so when I took a year off recently, I was a little nervous, like, oh, how is that going to go?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, my advice was, you know, I really try to not, first and foremost, take away from the kids, you know, especially when they're young. So I would write either early in the morning or when they're napping or at night. I'm not as good at this anymore, but I used to, when I was first writing, I wrote a ton at school. If I had a free period or if the kids were taking a quiz, they could have been cheating their asses off. I had no idea. They were small classes. I was writing, and honestly, for me, it was like a great lesson in time management. Didn't have the luxury of like, oh, do you have a writing ritual? I hate those questions. Like, because I think they're kind of dangerous. Like, you don't need a writing ritual. You need to know you have this amount of time.
It keeps you from writing.
Yeah. I wrote a big chunk of Disappearance of Devil's Rock sitting in a college sort of gymnasium because my son had baseball clinics there. And it wasn't games. It was like him and 50 other kids just throwing the ball. So I was like, I don't have to watch him do that. I can sit here and write this novel. You know, I had earbuds in and balls were flying all over the place. But I wrote a swath of chapters that way, just because, oh, I'm going to be here for 2 hours. I have to use it. You know, part of it, I had my mentor and friend, Stuart Onan, used to talk about how he would literally tie a belt around his waist at the chair and wouldn't like untie it until after 2 hours went by.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, so I sort of just admired that idea. It's like, you know, sometimes you can't afford to wait around for inspiration to show up, you know, if you're going to want to try to do this thing as a thing like every day. And I found that, I mean, I don't literally tie the belt, but I found if I force my, even when I don't feel like it, if I force myself, you know, the first 5, sometimes 10 minutes really suck.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually the subconscious is like, this is really boring. Fine. I'll send you something.
I would just walk around with a chair stuck to me.
Yeah. Like,
so, you know, you're at the start of this tour, but like I've seen you do a few podcasts, a few interviews, and I noticed like you're getting kind of asked like the same things. I try to stay away from Knock at the Cabin because
no,
that,
it's not a problem. Yeah.
But is there anything like about this book that you want to talk about that like no one's asked you yet?
Oh, I don't know. I don't mean to be dismissive. Like, yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, there's like my favorite scene, which is obnoxious, but like, I don't want to talk about it because it's a big spoiler.
Because you can't, right?
Yeah.
I think it's probably my favorite scene too.
all I would say though is like for most of my novels, I have what I call like a carrot at the end of the stick scene. Because I don't know about, there's a lot of writers out there. Thank you for coming. I don't know how you work. Like, do you write it in the order or do you skip around?
I know what you're talking about in the sense that there were like things that I knew were going to like kind of like touchstones that I knew were going to happen that I really wanted to write to.
Yeah.
So then, yeah, like that kind of like pushes you forward in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My character at the end of the stick scenes tend to be always like in the last third of the book. And if I just went and wrote those, I would never write all the hard stuff that came before it. So mm-hmm. like getting through all the, you know, the middle of the book, which is always the hardest toward that scene is to me, that's sort of not that I even knew exactly what was going to happen in the scene. I just knew I was going to do something weird with, with a shot in the hallway kind of thing.
I mean, it's the best part.
Oh, thank you.
It is the best part. Oh, I was telling you before, like it, when I got into that scene, I was like, I hate Paul. And then like, it kept going and I was like, I love this. So like, you've written a book where it's like whether you think it's good or bad is like the least interesting thing to like discuss about it. Like it's very challenging in that sense, which like makes it I think my like favorite book of yours.
Thank you. I mean, I'm honored. Yeah. I mean, so part of it, like, you know, with horror, you know, so comparing movies to reading, like I'm sure like most smart writers that are in the room, you probably started. You probably started reading for pleasure at a very young age.
No.
No, I didn't become like a reader for pleasure until I graduated college, like that summer after graduation. I was, again, the math major, et cetera.
Yeah.
And for me, my understanding of story from, you know, from ages 5 to 20 was TV and film. That's how I knew story structure. But then I sort of had to rewire myself once I fell in love with reading. I mean, I felt myself being rewired and being really interested, you know, in the 30 years since I read on average like between 60 and 80, sometimes more novels a year. So I've definitely played catch up. But that lack of that little like self-esteem issue was like, I didn't learn how to write, you know, in college or that like is always there, which for me, it's healthy. Like, it makes me want to read more and, you know, and work harder. But anyway, so this book was like, part of what excited me was like, I'm going to try to like, you know, make parts of this feel like a movie, but then do like a weird book thing with it at the same time and see like how they, you know, maybe how they mesh and maybe how they sort of like, you know, butt heads.
Mm-hmm. I had something similar where I wanted to be a film director for so long. It wasn't until high school I read Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. I don't know if anyone's read that. And it like blew my mind. I was like, okay, I want to be a writer. But then I only read Hermann Hesse. So like when I got into college, I wrote like an early 20th century German author. And it wasn't until like I was watching Fight Club in my dorm room and someone passed by and they were like, oh, the book's really good. And I was like, there's a book. And that kind of like just changed everything for me. So I have a lightning round of questions.
That's amazing. I didn't know I don't know if I knew the Hermann Hesse origin story.
Yeah, I keep it close to the vest. So first question, lobster roll or clam chowder?
Oh, definitely clam chowder. I don't love lobster.
No?
Well, part of the problem also is lobster rolls have mayonnaise in them and I hate mayonnaise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've had multiple lobster rolls. I don't think I realized mayonnaise within. I hate mayonnaise too.
Oh no! Now you're not gonna be able to have.
I'm never eating them again. Jason Tatum or Paul Pierce?
Oh, that's a. Well, I mean, Tatum's definitely a better player. I think I'm gonna still go with Tatum.
Yeah.
Like partly because he's just been getting so much flack and grief, both like national press and in. One of my vices is I listen to a lot of sports radio at home. Sorry. That's how I turn off my brain. Like for me, like watching movies and reading, you know, I do to be me, but that's still like, there's a part of my brain that's still working, you know, the writer mm-hmm. is still working. So I get to watch and sports and listen to it. That's when I get to relax and just, you know, shut down for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's my excuse for listening to sports radio. Yeah, Jason Tatum.
It's Tetris for me. That's what shuts my brain off, Tetris, is playing Tetris. Nice. The Town or The Departed?
I have seen neither.
Oh,
I know.
And you're from New England?
I know.
Wow. Leather jacket or army jacket?
I'm going to say leather now because I have one. It's way more expensive, so I have to wear it whenever the weather warrants it. Yeah.
So I just recently read The Paul Bearers Club.
Yeah.
And when there's like a description of Art Barbara in it that like pulled me back to the first time I met you, which was at Lit Fest in Connecticut. And like there's a Q&A going on stage. And like across the room, I can see John Langan. And I was like, is that John Langan? Like, so when the event ends, I go up to him and I'm like, John, I'm a huge, like, I just nerd out. Yeah. I'm like, I love your work. So he's just like being polite and nodding and being like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then I think like to get saved, he's like, oh, hi, Ellen. And then like Ellen Datlow comes by and I was like, holy crap. Like, what just happened? And they start having a conversation, and like in any other situation, I would have like pulled back, but I was like, no, I'm standing right here. So as they're talking, like I see John's eyes kind of like go above me, and he's like, hey, Paul. And I turned, and the light was behind you, and you were wearing a leather jacket. Yeah. So like all I saw was this like dark silhouette gleaming from the sides, and then reading Paul Bearers Club, I was like, oh, he's Art Barbara.
Oh, that's so embarrassing. But yeah. That was fun. The four of us ended up having a nice brunch at the end of the
great.
Weekend.
Yeah, it was a great weekend.
Ellen's a hoot if you ever get a chance to have brunch with her.
All right.
I don't know if the author photo, though, for Paul Bearers Club, if you get the hardback, I'm wearing Mercy's jacket in the author photo.
Are you?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have to look back
just
at it
to
now.
To entertain myself. That's the only reason why I did it, yeah.
Lake Mungo or The Thing?
Oh, you're making me choose between two children.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know. I refuse this choice. I guess I have to go with The Thing.
Yes. I think it's my favorite horror movie, is The Thing.
It is, yeah. I mean, also at the age when I saw it, like, and I've seen it so many times since, like, I feel like, you know, it was such a formative thing.
Mm.
Like, adult Paul, whatever weird person he's become, was certainly changed by Lake Mungo. I'm talking about myself in the third person. Stop. Stop this recording.
You know, you suggested Lake Mungo to me, and then I watched it, and I was terrified by it. It was so, yeah. I mean, it's not like a jump scary movie. It's just like a very, like, grief-ridden film, but like, I guess like the horror just comes out of the grief. It expresses itself in these strange ways. That it was haunting,
absolutely
haunting.
Yeah, like so. Like you said, you wouldn't watch a movie will you watch a movie when your wife is asleep?
Yeah, because she's in the house. I could wake her
up. Well, so I watched Lake Mungo when everyone was asleep and it was dark. It was the only time I had to purposely pick up my phone because I wasn't going to be able to handle what I was going to see. But I was still, like, you know, freaking out.
Yeah, that ending is very freaky.
Yeah.
All right, this is going to be a weird one. This is for all you, like, Paul heads out there. Sharks or pickles?
Sharks, because, I mean, from a distance, they're cool.
Okay.
From any distance, pickles are not cool.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is my last one. I don't know if, are you familiar with the man-bear debate happening on social media?
Yes.
Okay, so this one is tailored specifically for you. If you were alone in the woods, would you rather run into John Langan or Laird Barron?
Oh, John Langan.
John Langan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like if nothing else, one, I feel like I could, although my knees are kind of bulky now, I could outrun them. I feel like if worse came to worse, I could probably tickle John. I don't think Laird's ticklish.
I feel like Laird would appear and disappear.
Yes,
in like
absolutely.
All these, yeah, you're just like, oh, great, I'm in a short story by Laird Barron.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd hear John coming because he couldn't help himself. He would laugh and he'd make that high-pitched noise. Oh, it's Paul Tremblay. Like he waves his hand like that.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I guess that's the only answer to go with. So that's all I got.
All right. Well, let me ask you. So I mentioned, you know, Gus Azuz, your first novel, right? Or have you written?
No, that was my first.
That was published. First thing, not the first novel you've written.
Oh, no. It was like my seventh novel.
Okay.
Yeah.
This Thing Between Us, an amazing book. Like I said, it's one of the, you know, within the last decades, like, I mean, there are many great books out there, but this book, legitimately, I was afraid. I don't, like most books, I have like a lingering sense of dread. I'll think about it later and it picks at me, which your book did too. But there's a moment in the second half of the book where I was like, I'm really like scared right now. Anyway, so I want to know, do you have another one coming?
Thank you, first of all. That's very humbling to hear. Working on a second book. I can't really talk about it just only because, so I've done the mistake of like, going on a podcast or something being like, yeah, so this is what I'm working on. And it's about, vampires on the Appalachian Trail. And then I get to a point, I'm like, I don't want to do that anymore.
Oh.
And so there are like interviews out there where I've described like three different books. So like, I don't want to jinx it, but yeah, currently working on a second book. I've already gotten like the edits from my editor.
Oh, great.
So yeah, doing that. Couple other projects that like aren't finalized contract-wise, so like can't really speak on them, but
sure.
Yeah, hopefully 2025 is big.
Can you say?
Like comic book.
Okay, I was gonna ask comics. Or,
yeah, working on a comic book, maybe like movie stuff, who knows, nice. Yeah.
Were you a big comics reader, or is that something that's recent?
I wasn't a big comic. I've read comics like all of my life, but like wasn't like a huge comic book reader. It was literally, I was looking up comic books for my niece for her to read because she's like a big horror head, but I didn't want to give her like a Junji Ito comic book or manga to be like, read this. So I'm like, what can I give to kids? And I like found something from this comic book publisher. And as I'm like purchasing it, I get an email from like their editor that's like, hey, I read your book, like I loved it, do you have any ideas? And I was like, yeah, I do. So nice. Yeah, that's kind of just how it happened.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So are we taking questions from the audience?
Folks, just wait until I bring the microphone around for the sake of those listening and watching along online so that they can hear. But raise your hand if you have a question. If you are following along online, please type your question into the Q&A box at the bottom of the screen.
Don't say it to your computer.
So you confirmed something that I also agree with, which is that the middle of a book is the hardest to write. And I'm asking what your advice is on writing the middle of a book. The beginning and the end are the most fun. But
yeah. Yeah, and for me, I don't know about you or you, Gus. Like, I usually, well, obviously, I know what the start is because I'm going to start there. I usually have a sense of the ending. It can be hazy, but you know, so the hard part is getting from A to Z. You know, for some books, I've actually written an outline before, which I found helpful. Maybe for about 2/3 of my novels, I've written some form of a plot outline. Some of them are more detailed than others. I did not write one for horror movie though. It felt like, I'll back up a little bit. I'll say that, you know, now that I'm in this weird position, you know, I'm very happy to be, but like, I never thought I would be, where I've written a bunch of books. Like, I'm trying to balance like the confidence. Oh, you've written something before, you can do it again. But I also want to try to make it feel like different and special and not ever have it feel like boring in a job kind of thing. So there's that weird balance of, oh, like I want that confidence. But so anyway, with horror movie, it felt like I'm not going to write a outline for this. I'm just going to take like a lot of notes. And my notebook looked like an insane person wrote it. It's just like stuff spilled all over the place. So I sort of outlined as I went. As far as advice, for me, it's just like a variation on like of the tying the belt around my waist. Like once I'm in a novel, my goal is 500 words a day. And I write everything, I write it in the order I think it's going to be. So I know that doesn't work for everybody. Even like, you know, most of my books, the timeline shift and everything. But like I wrote Horror Movie, what you're reading is the order in which I wrote it. I took one little scene with the director and moved it up. That was the only thing that changed as far as like the timeline goes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, I think the middle, I don't know, so I feel like where you sort of like earn it. You know, it sucks when you're doing it, but like, you know, I'm very pleased like when you get to the end. Like, I'm addicted to the feeling of having a draft. That's like my favorite part, obviously, right? I mean, there's still a lot of work to do, but once I finally have the whole thing, because I do a lot of editing as I go, you know, that's the part that keeps me coming back. So, you know, if the middle wasn't hard, that wouldn't, you know, I probably wouldn't feel the same.
There'd be
so, like, I didn't give any advice. I'm sorry. I don't know. Do you have any advice?
You know, what usually happens is like when I'm writing, I'm like, I don't need any help like in the beginning. And then I'll usually get to a part where I'm like, I will like write like mini outlines. of just like the beats that I like, the things. Oh, here we go with beats. The things that I know are gonna happen, like that I need to get to, and I'm like, okay, what order? And then I'll just like write to that, and then be like, okay, but now what else? And then I'll write another mini outline. But yeah, like I've tried doing like the full outline, and it's just like, well, there's the novel.
Yeah.
Like, why am I gonna
That's
write
the
it
danger
now?
For sure.
It just makes it like dead. That and then like doing a lot of research too becomes like so daunting that you're like, I have to include all this. Mm. And then you're just like, well, I don't want to write this. So avoid those things. And you should write, be able to write something.
Don't research, don't outline.
Yeah.
That's the summation.
All right, I have a question. So I'm a writer, and I'm not a scaredy cat, never have been. But I'm aware of that fear of becoming too cynical in my writing. So I'm wondering if you have any advice as far as how to nurture that inner scaredy cat on the page.
I still sort of focus on myself just because I feel like I don't, because what's, I mean, specific to scares, right? Because what's scary is so subjective, just like humor, right? Humor, what makes you laugh, what makes me laugh is different. I mean, I think we can intellectualize, oh, that's supposed to be funny. Oh, that's supposed to be scary. But I have no idea. You know, the things I try to like personally connect with is the characters for me are the one, you know, if I ever get stuck, I focus on the characters. You know, I like to think I'm focusing on them anyway, but you know, if I can make people want to feel what the characters are feeling or empathize with them, that's, I feel like I'm in more control of moving the reader sort of emotionally. And, you know, I do know what's disturbing. At least I think I know what's disturbing. You know, and if anything's scary, great, but I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of people I know who aren't scaredy cats who write, like, you know, really good horror. I don't know if that's, I don't think it's a prerequisite.
No, somewhere in Maine, Stephen King is listening to Mambo Number 5, like typing out the scariest thing he can think of.
Yeah.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you, were you satisfied or dissatisfied with M. Night Shyamalan's adaption of your book?
Yeah, I mean, I guess ultimately satisfied. I mean, I like the movie, but hate the ending. Although I like talking about and thinking about the differences between the ending and the book. I mean, it was a really head-spinning, amazing, and sometimes frustrating experience. And obviously, the movie itself is the least frustrating part of the experience. The more frustrating part was the 6 months leading up to the movie where things were more difficult than they had to be in terms of, like, being left off posters and, hey, why are you fighting the movie tie-in edition and all sorts of weird stuff that, you know, seems just to be part of the deal with Hollywood. Mm-hmm. In horror movie, the thin kid meets a writer, a very sort of like a caricature of a horror writer, you know, making fun of us a little bit, but like, you know, hopefully in a way that horror writers would laugh at. But he talks about how his film agent said, hey, you know, I'm going to pitch you as a creator, not a writer, because no one out here respects writers. That's something that my, you know, I put that in the book. A film agent said that to me. So, I mean, again, but it was an amazing experience. Like, my favorite part of the movie is the performances by the actors. I thought they were wonderful. I thought they really connected. And there's a connection between them and the characters in the book. You know, so I really enjoyed that part of it.
We're going to take a question from one of our folks online real quick. Laura, who asks, what's been the hardest component of writing for you to master? Descriptive writing, dialogue, character, plot, and what advice would you give to others on how to develop it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've mastered any part of writing. I mean, that's the first thing, and that's okay. Like, hopefully all writers take comfort in that. That, you know, you're not going to master anything. Every time it's new. I mean, that's frustrating, but it should be exciting. And, you know, hopefully it feels that takes some of the pressure off of you. But for me, it's always been plot. Like, I feel the least comfortable with plot. And that's kind of why, especially for my earlier novels, I did a lot of outlines. My outlines, like for the first two thirds of the book and the last third, was like, oh, I'm not sure yet. And that was helpful, especially when I was writing things that had maybe a lot of plot going. I've always felt much more comfortable with voice and character. But again, that's not to say that those are easy too. You still have to work at those. As far as advice goes, like if plot is like your difficult thing, you know, I would suggest trying to write like a rough outline and give yourself permission to deviate from it whenever you can. I know as far as like characters go, I always, this will be the last blab, and then if you've got some advice. for characters, the first things I always wrote, especially as someone who wasn't like, you know, again, didn't take English courses in college, you know, I started writing things first person because I thought that would be easier. Obviously, it's not. But the lesson for me for first person was, how do I build the other characters? Because I'm not in their heads, it's just first person. I'm like, okay, well, I only know anybody by what they say and what they do, right? I can't go into their head. So I think approaching all your characters that way is like, you know, I think it's an obvious thing, but like the, you know, what they say and what they do on the page is what's going to build the character, less than like what, you know, what's going on in their head necessarily.
Mm-hmm. You see, and it, for me, plot comes super easy. Like, I think it's just from growing up in the 90s and seeing like Michael Bay films and like all these action films where it's just all plot, that it, like, I feel like I can follow a story in that sense. And it's always been the description that's difficult for me. So what I've usually like decided, what I've like settled on is just being like succinct as possible. Like I don't try to like do the descriptive game, because I'm going to lose at it. So like what can I do to like get this visual as succinct as possible so we can just move on from it? That's what works for me. Everything else, just play to your strengths.
That's interesting.
So since Stephen King got brought up, what is your favorite Stephen King book?
Well, I mean, the one that turned me into a reader was The Stand, but I would say probably Pet Sematary. Maybe his more bleaker stuff. Yeah. I mean, I love his short stories too, but Pet Sematary, and then actually I have a real love for Revival, a more recent one, especially like if you read those two back to back. I think Revival is sort of approaching the same questions about death and existence, but from a much older person's point of view. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so harrowing.
Yeah. Yeah. Pet Sematary, I would say, is my favorite too. Just for the longest time, it was It, just because of the cosmic horror elements. Like, I just was so into. But Pet Sematary is fantastic, and it's all like within like the last 80 pages that just like the things go like super crazy. Otherwise, you're just with this family and just like trying to settle in this new area, and these like tragic things happen to them. Which like you're expecting a Stephen King book to be like the like Stephen King vocabulary and just like his usual like touchstones, but oh, that book is like so good.
Agreed.
When you think about the process of one of your books being adapted into a film, which of your other books do you feel would translate best into another film?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I always thought Cabin, I mean, was a somewhat obvious choice. I mean, because I sort of imagined I was writing, not that I know anything about writing plays, but I was imagining for a lot of that story, I was writing like, you know, a play in like one room kind of thing. I mean, I would love a horror movie to be made, but it would be really hard and strange.
It would be
just
so
for
hard.
One scene.
Oh, I mean, that, yeah. You need Michael Haneke to like film that movie.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, maybe A Head Full of Ghosts would be fun, but I'd also like much, I think like most, if it's a novel, like I think most of novelists would prefer like a limited series where you get to do sort of like everything instead of, you know, just like 90 minutes of it.
I would say Survivor Song. Like it's basically Mad Max Fury Road, but with like a rabies outbreak, yeah. Instead of just the wasteland.
That works too. Let's do it. You're going to write the screenplay.
I'm on it.
All right. We've got time for one more question.
Hi, so I was wondering, when you're starting a new novel and you're sort of designing or meeting your protagonist, is there something in particular you like to do to figure out who this person is, or do they just kind of show up to you fully formed?
That's a great question. Most of the time, I definitely take like, I'll do like free writing notes and little notebooks before I start writing. Even if I don't do an outline, like I'll write down the character's name and try to figure out what they look like to me. Usually I'm stealing their physical appearance from somebody I know. I should say borrowing, not stealing. And I tell them eventually. Usually after, like, to ask, you know, say sorry instead of asking for permission. But no, like, I'll take notes and try to just get, like, a few pieces. But really, to go back a little bit what I'd said before, like, they don't really start becoming, like, the characters until they say something or do something. But I do find, like, beforehand, like, just getting their physicalness just helps as a good, like, starting point.
Yeah, I would say like something similar in that it's usually I have some type of like a piece of dialogue that I overheard someone say that I'm like, this perfectly captures. Mm. Like I remember being in like a group message and we were talking about the like Obi-Wan Star Wars show. And we were like, oh yeah, it's gonna be terrible. And someone in the group was like, yeah, I hope it's so bad that only I like it. And I was like, oh yeah, it perfectly captures your terrible personality that you would say something like that. That I like banked it in my head. I was like, oh, that's like such an amazing thing to say.
That is an amazing thing to say.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, thank you everyone for coming out tonight. And please join me in thanking Paul and Gus for that wonderful conversation.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.